This is KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. This is Dan Zhang on this Labor Day 2006. We will be airing a May Day special that we aired earlier this year, because May Day is actually how the rest of the world celebrates Labor Day. And so we will go to that momentarily. The opinions expressed on this show are not necessarily those of the Regents of the University of California, nor the management of KUCI. This is KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. Coming up, Subversity with Dan Zhang. Today we're going to be talking about Mexican migration and the history of U.S.-Mexico relations in terms of Mexican labor. With us will be a professor of Chicano Latino Studies, labor historian, Gil Gonzalez. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Dan. Thank you for having me.
It's May Day. It's significant for many reasons in history. Do you know why this day was picked for this activity?
Well, I can imagine. One of the reasons, I think, is that when we look around the world, particularly in Latin America, May Day is a day for workers to have parades and to celebrate Labor Day. Here we have it in September, but they celebrate it as it should have been celebrated, celebrating the Haymarket Square massacre of in the late 19th century. So I believe that it had a lot to do with a traditional a day for workers to honor themselves and honor workers. And so it was brought here into the United States. And so this is a kind of measure of the overwhelming migration that has occurred over the past 20 years, 25 years to the United States from Mexico and now Central America and Latin America. This is very much a reflection of the overwhelming numbers of immigrants, both legal and undocumented, who have come particularly since the era of free trade. And it was very evident to me, and when Raul and I were writing our book, A Century of Chicano History, that the older kind of protest movement that we sort of associate with the 60s and 70s was being sort of becoming no longer applicable in because of the numbers of immigrants today, so that what we are seeing is the politics of the immigrant community, whereas in the 60s and 70s, in my era of activity, what we saw was the activities of the second, third generation. And so that's what I think has a lot to do with this, is the numbers of immigrants who have come in and have taken the driver's seat in terms of the politics from the Latino community, which is really the politics of the immigrant community. And we can compare that to the 60s, which is really the politics of the second, third generation. And I can see it on campus, too, so that students back in the early 70s, when I first started here, few of them spoke Spanish. Mm-hmm. Today, they all speak Spanish. Mm. And that's an example of what we're talking about. Many of them are immigrants.
Right.
And I've even had students who are, for example, undocumented.
Right.
And students who are documented themselves, immigrants themselves. So that's a whole different kind of population. Even though they're all Latinos, all Chicanos, it's a community which is now to a large degree comprised of immigrants. And when I started graduate school, the immigrant population comprised only about 17% of the Chicano population. Today it's 50% and climbing.
Oh, yeah.
So I think this is just a reflection of the politics reflecting the immigrant numbers.
There's also a split between the mainstream Mexican-American establishment, I suppose, and the more newer immigrants and the more grassroots kind of thing, do you think? Do you see it that way?
Well,
like I talked to one of the former UCI employee who's Latino, and he was saying, why don't people wait in line? Why do they jump the queue? I guess that kind of stuff.
Well, I look at certain organizations such as the
right.
National Council La Raza or League of United Latin American Citizens, Mexican American Legal Defense Fund, which are really traditional mainline organizations, and they've come out very much in support of the main objectives of these marches. And the main objectives of the marches are, I think, fairly much what I would say in tune with the general community, with the mainstream community as well. Building the wall, I don't think large numbers of the Latino community, second or third generation, think highly of that, and that's one of the big issues.
Right.
The Sensenbrenner bill, the protection or helping undocumented immigrants, for example. Mahoney comes out in favor of that, and the Catholic Church
it
generally is supportive of that.
Yeah.
So I would say that while there are some in the Latino community who say, stand in line, wait to get your papers, don't cross over illegally, and so on, I would say that the majority are pretty much in tune with the marchers.
And it's actually not that radical, even that's what George Bush is pushing for, right, in some ways, some part of it.
No, actually, it's hard to say exactly where the politics of these demonstrations, where they begin and end. We know that, for example, they're against the Sensenbrenner Bill. 4437
right.
is aimed at. But on the other hand, what about the guest worker program and legalization? Probably legalization is another demand. Legalize those people who've been here and are working and so on and so forth. But on the other hand, the guest worker program is not clearly defined, I don't think. And also what is not being talked about are the causes of Mexican migration. That's sort of been left out. And I mentioned this once before here at a demonstration on campus, that the discussion on immigration reform is pretty well controlled by Washington, so that the demonstrations have been a response to, rather than a concrete set of proposals that these demonstrators demand should be put into or implemented. So what is being discussed is what is being proposed.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, immigration reform. Immigration reform is being proposed. Sensenbrenner on the one hand, McCain, Kennedy, Cornyn, who knows how many other people are proposposing things. And so the discussion circulates around that.
Yeah.
And what I think needs to be done is to have a set of proposals that come from, that originate from within the community. And I think the very first thing that needs to be done is to discuss why this migration. And I'm in agreement with Kitty Calavita in social ecology, who said there's really no way of creating an effective immigration reform as long as Mexico is an underdeveloped country. Now, the question is, why is Mexico an underdeveloped country? Why are people coming to the United States in such huge numbers? Why are they risking their lives? And that has not really been put on the put forward for discussion significantly enough. And another thing that needs to be discussed is U.S. economic relations, particularly the free trade agreement between the two countries, which is devastating to Mexico and which has led to this migration. So I think what needs to be done is, rather than dealing with what McCain puts out or what Kennedy puts out ag jobs or legalization. I think we have to move the discussion forward and discuss the causes of this migration, because there'll be no immigration reform, really. This migration will continue on to the future.
It'll be a stopgap measure.
Not even that. Mexican migration has been principally a migration of labor. And the immigration legislation that deals with Mexican migration, that is immigration legislation in the United States, deals with that migration as a migration of labor. Is modified and adjusted to that key characteristic. If you look over the course of the 20th century, legislation regarding Mexican migration has adjusted to that fact that it is a migration of labor. And this legislation has been geared to making sure that this labor is accessed in one way or another. So what we have is eras when there's a virtual open border, eras where you have contract labor programs, or the Immigration Act of 1924, National Quotas Act, which virtually excluded any quota on Mexican migration. And that's to ensure that Mexican migration will be readily accessed and utilized and exploited. So what we are seeing is a continuation of that convention within immigration law. It's not reform. it's updating how Mexican labor will be utilized. Mexican labor in Mexico right now, how it will be utilized in the future in the United States.
To serve business interests.
Agriculture, the service industry, hotels, and so on. In fact, there's a consortium of employers of immigrant labor that lobbied in 1999 for a guest worker program. And they're one of the key organizations which have been pushing for a guest worker program, and they represent hotels, resorts, a whole series of businesses and enterprises which hire immigrant labor, and they would like to see a guest worker program. And so we're not going to see reform. What we're going to see is a legislation that was going to deal with this overwhelming numbers of undocumented people coming into the United States and channeling them into a guest worker program, so that you will have a kind of revolving door system where they come in and leave, come in and leave. Whether it's going to work is another question.
We're talking with Professor Raul Fernandez, and this is, I brought up his name because you brought it up, and I was trying to say you were mentioning Raul, and this is Gil Gonzalez, and they've been co-authors on some works, and this is KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. The opinions expressed on the show are not necessarily those of the Regents of the University of California, nor the management of KUCI. Yeah, let's delve into the Professor Gonzalez. Let's delve into the background of the history of this migration and the impact of American capital in Mexico. You've written many books on this topic, and you have a new one just coming out this year. Has come out: Guest Workers or Colonized Labor, Mexican Labor Migration to the United States.
Yes. Well, in that particular book, I look at the old guest worker program, what is considered the classical guest worker program, the Bracero program, which operated from 1942 to 1964. in which hundreds and thousands of men were imported to the United States to work on temporary contracts, primarily in agriculture. We spoke earlier, and you mentioned that someone once compared it to a slave system. And in fact, a number of people, including Ernesto Galarza, saw this as a virtual slave system in which, we can go into that. I mean, there's a lot of aspects to it.
Did people mostly come to California at the time?
They came primarily to Texas and California, but they also went into Arkansas, Michigan, Oregon, Washington, New Mexico, Arizona. But it was primarily California and Texas who got the bulk of these workers. And one number that has been put out as the numbers of men who were brought into the United States is 450,000 over that 22-year period. It was supposedly established. It was established in 1942, but it was supposedly established to supply required number of laborers because the war was pulling people into the services and defense industry and so on, so there was a shortage of labor. That's a conventional explanation.
Which war?
Second World War. And when I looked into it, I found that one of the key lobbyists for the Bracero program in 1941 and 42 was Charles Teague. Charles Teague was president of the Southern California Fruit Growers Exchange, which is Sunkist. Now, Sunkist was having big problems with their labor supply, which was primarily Mexican labor supply, who had learned the art of organizing and striking. So in 1936, here in Orange County, it was the very first strike in the citrus industry, which lasted 3 weeks. And which was a very violent affair in which hundreds of workers were arrested. Vigilante groups were operating. The Santa Ana Register was calling for
shoot to kill.
Shoot to kill,
said.
Yeah.
The headline was shoot to kill.
Shoot to kill. And that strike in 1936 was followed by another strike in 1941 in Ventura County in which Teague's Ranch, Leffingwell Ranch, which was a 1,000-acre ranch which had a company town workers living on the ranch. They went out on strike in 41, and it was thousands of workers went out on strike, and they were evicted from their camps and so on. And those two strikes, plus the strikes that occurred throughout the 30s in cotton in the San Joaquin Valley, in agriculture in L.A. County, as well as in the Imperial Valley, 33, 34, and then there's a cotton strike in 38, agricultural labor becomes very unreliable, undependable. And the Bracero program, I believe, was instituted to a large extent to replace the existing Mexican labor supply and move them out. In fact, that's what happened in Orange County. The grower associations, there were about 45 packing houses, and they had their own labor supply and so on. There were about 25,000 Mexicans, citizens or Mexicans, forming part of the population here in Orange County at that time. They were virtually moved out of the labor supply, and the citrus grower associations instructed their foremen not to hire from the local labor supply, to employ only braceros, so that even when there were available Mexican workers for the citrus industry here, they would not be hired. And that's an example of what I'm talking about. The Bracero program was a means of replacing an organized and a politicized labor supply.
Who organized them? Was it a union or was it a independent?
Yeah,
is that an independent union? Or
there were a number of organizers. There were some people from the AFL who were active, but there were also members from the old Communist Party organization. What were they called? Cannery and Agricultural Workers Industrial Union. So they were active at the time. There were a number of radicals that were from the Mexican community who were participating in the Communist Party at the time.
Sure.
So, but the workers themselves were very available, made themselves available to labor organizing. So because of that, the Bracero program was utilized as a means of replacing the existing labor supply.
In fact,
that's exactly what happened across the board.
It wiped out the organized
workers. Yeah. So, I mean, like people are talking about, well, undocumented today are taking jobs away from the black community. But actually, guest workers in the past took jobs away from the Mexican community, the white community, the black community as well.
And these were people that were living here already.
Oh, almost. Yes.
Yeah.
The domestic labor supply, people who, you know, were living in settled communities and had been working maybe in citrus for decades and found themselves now pushed out because of, and I know a number of grower associations started to talk about the existing, the domestic labor supply is unreliable now. We don't want them anymore. But 10 years or 15, 20 years earlier, they were saying, this is these workers are wonderful. We love them. So it's the matter of when people learn how to organize and become independent and start putting down their own demands, their own political objectives and economic objectives, then they become unreliable.
Could you tie like the beginnings of United Farm Workers to this legacy or not?
To the Bracero?
Or to the organizing earlier?
One of the key leaders in organizing agricultural labor was Ernesto Galarza, who during the Bracero program attempted to organize farm workers. And what he found was that it was impossible. It was very, very difficult because the Braceros were brought in as strikebreakers virtually in places like the Imperial Valley. And so that he then became active in opposing the Bracero program because of, for a number of reasons. One, what it was doing to Mexican workers themselves, but what it was doing to domestic labor as well. And he and others were very successful in pointing out how the Bracero program was really an exploitative system. And he looked at the Bracero and he defined the Bracero as something of a ward to a patron, sort of like this medieval relationship, not of a free wage labor worker with an employer, but as someone who was subjected to the domination of another individual.
Like a feudal system.
A ward to a patron. And so he saw that as injurious to the Mexican workers brought in, as well as to those workers who were here already. And so there were a number of others who were also active in opposing it. The Catholic Church, for example, was also in opposition. And so when it ended in 64, it opened the door to Cesar Chavez to organize agricultural workers.
How did Filipino workers get into the picture? They were also involved in the farm work.
Right.
And were they recruited specifically for it, or were they already here, or what?
Well, first of all, it was a colony.
Oh, right. Yeah, I forgot.
It was a colony. And how they were brought in, I'm not exactly clear, but my assumption is that they were recruited in the same way that Mexican labor was recruited. There's a whole history behind the recruitment of Mexican labor, and it's still going on today. But if you go back to the early 20th century, late 19th century, Mexican labor was being recruited in Mexico and brought to the United States. So recruiters were, I'm sure, active in that they brought them also to Hawaii.
Mm-hmm.
and there are recruiters active in Puerto Rico, bringing them to, I know these, Salt River Valley in Arizona. So they were most probably recruited, and they became known as the boys, the Filipino workers, the boys, they were known as the boys. They replaced the Mexican labor, and particularly the Filipinos replaced the Japanese. And the Japanese had replaced the Chinese. So what we have is a series in agriculture, particularly in agriculture, a series of waves of labor that replaces the previous labor supply. So the Chinese were then excluded. And then the Japanese are excluded because they begin to form associations. And then the Filipinos are brought in, but there's not enough, so they bring in Mexicans as well. Then the Mexican labor that's here, particularly in the citrus industry, is then replaced by bracero labor. And then the braceros are going to be replaced by documented immigrants as well as undocumented immigrants. Now we'll probably see them being replaced by guest workers. And maybe the existing undocumented labor supply will become a portion of the guest worker program. So they will be incorporated. I guess that's what Bush is talking about, incorporating the existing undocumented labor supply into a guest worker program. If they start bringing in guest workers from Mexico, then they will probably replace an existing labor supply. And it's a repeat of a history of replacement of existing labor supply.
Is it a reaction to organizing now or not?
I think that this is primarily a means of controlling the undocumented migration, which has become so overwhelming. And I think that's what this guest worker program or these discussions are all about. Rather than dealing with the cause of this migration, deal with the symptoms of what is occurring in Mexico. People come, so the Mexican migration is being dealt with solely north of the border, rather than looking at it, looking at the roots of this migration. And in order to understand this migration, in order to explain it, we have to look at the actions of American capital in Mexico. And I recall the work of Ernesto Galarza. In 1949, he wrote a piece in Common Ground, 1949. It was the article was titled Program for Action. And he had this to say, and I have this quote right in front of me, but it's very, very interesting. I think it has to be applied. He said he, the migrant, is forced to seek better conditions north of the border by the slow but relentless pressure of United States agricultural, financial, and oil corporate interests on the entire economic and social evolution of the Mexican nation. And he said, and he goes on to say that to ignore this basic premise is to overlook the roots of the problem. So the roots of Mexican migration can't be explained simply by looking at what's happening in Mexico and separate Mexico from the actions of U.S. economic policy across the border. And we have to do that today to continue to look at this migration. And the free trade agreement is at the root of this massive migration. Free trade in general is uprooting people throughout Mexico, sending them on a migratory trail within Mexico. And this migratory trail goes northward to the assembly plants that are, there's about 3,000 assembly plants, and about 80% of them are on the northern border. 1,000 of them are just here in the Tijuana, Ensenada area. And people move north because that's where the jobs are. And if there are no jobs, they come across the United States. I mean,
I once went down to I walked across to Tijuana and with John O, and he's a labor activist, and we took a cab to one of these factories, and what we call it, Hyundai or Coca-Cola or whatever had plants over there, I think, and they would patrol with people with guns. They were like, was fenced in, and then there was housing on the hills. I think they built some housing, and so it's this huge area.
Yeah, well. Today, Mexico is a virtual economic colony of the United States. 40% of the employed peoples of Mexico work for an American concern in Mexico. That's 40%.
Wow.
Can you imagine that? The largest retailer in Mexico is Walmart. In fact, Walmart is the largest employer, 170,000 workers. Delphi is the next largest employer in Mexico with 70,000 workers.
What does Delphi do?
Automobile parts.
Oh, right. Yeah.
The largest industrial employer are the assembly plants, most of them located along the northern border, which pay poverty wages. And so people are living in shack towns, communities without sewage and like that. But Mexico is virtually an economic colony. 40% of employment is generated by American concerns there. But not only that, when we're talking about migration, we have to look at what free trade has done, what the North American Free Trade Agreement signed in 1994 has done to Mexico. Just today, yesterday I was reading an article in the commentary in the Orange County Register, and it attempts to explain migration. And, of course, it just says Mexico can't develop itself. It doesn't have the will. It doesn't have the cultural attributes that is required to lead Mexico into modernization. It's in the commentary section, the very first page, something like that. And what they don't recognize is that the North American Free Trade Agreement has opened the doors to American agricultural products, not just agricultural products, livestock, for example, as well, meat products. Mexico at one time was...
exporter, right?
Well, it produced its own food supply, corn, beans, rice, soya, dairy products, chicken. It sustained itself. In fact, one of the fundamentals of every nation state is its ability to feed itself. An economy is primarily agricultural to feed the peoples. That's true of every nation state. What Mexico lost to the free trade agreement was its ability to feed itself, in that it opened the free trade agreement demanded from Mexico that it opened its doors to the import of American goods, corn, for example. At one time, Mexico produced all of its own corn supply. Now, the overwhelming, I think it's 70% of its corn supply comes from the United States. Dairy products, beef, chicken, soy, rice are now imported from the United States. Now, what that is doing is not making life better for the vast majority of Mexicans. What it's doing is it's ruining those agriculturalists, those ranchers who lived on producing goods for the marketplace. Most of them were small ranchers, but some were medium-sized as well. People who grew dairy products, for example, are going out of business. They're going bankrupt. And the bankruptcy rate at the countryside is huge. Every day about 600 people, according to studies by Mexican sociologists, every day 600 people leave the countryside. They migrate, and most of them migrate northward because that's where jobs are available. During the era of the governorship of Vicente Fox, when he was governor of the state of Guanajuato, whatever it was, 10 years, I don't know, I think it's 6 years, maybe less, 20% of the population of the rural countryside left their villages. And what we're seeing across Mexico is the desertion of villages on a widespread scale.
Do they get better pay, though, in the urban areas now?
Well, the unemployment rate in Mexico right now is probably around 40%.
Wow.
But if you count the people who are selling apples on a corner or cleaning your windshield at a stop sign, the poverty rate in Mexico, according to one study, the poverty rate is 73%.
Wow.
Now, the government study is 40%. So, but it's probably at least one half of the population live under the level of poverty by the standards of Mexico. We know that in Tijuana, which is has hundreds of assembly plants located there, hiring thousands of people. I think there's 250,000 people working in assembly plants in the area. One half the population live in poverty. One half of the population, by the standards of Mexico.
Mm.
And so the free trade agreement has a great deal to do with this migration within Mexico, people being uprooted on a massive scale, sent on a migratory trail, which comes northward because that's where the assembly plants are, and then crosses into the United States. Now, this is not anything new. In the work that Raul and I wrote, Century of Chicano History, we looked at the late 19th and early 20th century, and what we found was that the actions of American capital, in the same way that Ernesto Galarza pointed out, the actions of American capital, particularly the railroads, which were constructed by American concerns, uprooted people on a massive scale in the late 19th century. Something like 300,000 people, peasants, were uprooted and sent on a migratory trail. And they were hired by American oil companies, American railroads, American mining companies, and they were pulled northward. And there was a massive redistribution of the Mexican population northward. And so what we see then is the development of a landless population working for American corporations. This is the late 19th and early 20th century, a northward migration caused by the actions of American capital. And we see a repeat of that today with the free trade agreement. Is uprooting people on a massive scale and sending them on a migratory trail, which ends up in places like Santa Ana here, Santa Ana, or Long Beach, or East Los Angeles, and so on. So that we cannot just look at this migration and say, well, it's what happens when people cross the border. No. Migration begins in the villages in Mexico, in the small communities, in the towns and cities. It begins there, and it ends here. And as long as this immigration reform is merely looking at people after they cross the border, then we're not going to do anything about it. So the causes of this migration, we have to look at what Ernesto Galarza said. You have to look at the actions of American capital in Mexico.
We're talking with Professor Gil Gonzalez here on KCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. And KUCI.org on the web. There was a speaker that was for globalization, Jagdish Bhagwati, who's a professor of economics and law at Columbia. And when he spoke on campus, there were protests. His point was that it's globalization can be good for you, or is good for you.
I'd like to know for whom. For Cargill? Archer Daniels Mitchell. It's in Mexico. It hasn't benefited the vast majority of the population. When we know that such a huge number of people are living under the poverty line, and studies have been carried out, especially in indigenous communities of Mexico, which show that the conditions in these places are as bad as the conditions existing in the worst areas of Africa, where malnutrition is common, where diseases that would normally not appear are common. And we're seeing these conditions, which appear in the 90s in Mexico, appearing now through Central America. There was just an article in the LA Times a couple of weeks ago discussing rice farmers in Honduras who are going broke because they can't compete against American rice, which is being dumped because of a free trade agreement. And so what we're going to be seeing is a massive migration from all of Latin America, and the attempts to control this migration through this immigration reform is not going to succeed. It cannot succeed. So the United States wants its cake and wants to eat it at the same time. It wants to have free trade. But this free trade at the same time is uprooting peoples on a massive scale and sending them on a migratory trail, which ends up in the U.S. And so what we're seeing now is migration from Central America going through Mexico, right, and coming to the United States. And we're seeing, again, a replication of what is occurring in Mexico, the desertion of villages, where families are now uprooting. And we're seeing increasing numbers of women who are migrating because, whereas before perhaps it was the man, right? Mm-hmm. Now it's women migrating on their own and from Central America through Mexico. And it's a very, very, very difficult situation. And now what we're seeing is a business that has risen because of the massive numbers of people and because of Operation Gatekeeper and so on and so forth, of smugglers, coyotes. Mm-hmm. Now, the smugglers are considered to be criminals and crooks and bad people, right? But what they're bringing to the United States are the very same people who are working as nannies here in Newport Beach, or working as busboys in various upscale restaurants and so on. They bring people to the border, and what we see then is that they're being recruited from the border. Now, give you an example of who's recruiting these people who are smuggled into the United States. Are the contractors working for, Halliburton was hired to do some of the reconstruction in New Orleans, right?
Oh, New Orleans, yeah.
Yeah. Well, they went and contracted with a whole series of small concerns to clean up bases and do all sorts of things. Well, where were they recruiting from?
Wow.
At the border. They're recruiting undocumented workers. In fact, there's an article by Roberto Lovato that I'm not sure exactly where it appeared. I have that article. But he looks at these contractors. Now, what we see then is a process of migration, of labor being brought by coyotes to the border or to Santa Ana, let's say. Mm-hmm. And then they are put onto another recruiting trail, a recruiting process. And I'm giving you one example of this in terms of the recruiters that have gone to the border to bring workers to New Orleans. We find the same thing with the chicken Tyson was doing the same thing, going to the border and recruiting workers and taking them into their Arkansas chicken processing plants. What we are seeing then is a single migratory process, right? People removed from their communities through the actions of U.S. economic policy and the actions of American enterprises opening the doors to their products in Mexico. And the actions are the uprootings of people. They're coming to the border, and they're continuing on till they find jobs in the United States. What immigration reform does is it separates that process. It only looks at the process from the border northward. Mm-hmm. But that's only half of it. The other half is ignored. And as long as that other half is ignored, as Galarza said, then you will never really have an immigration reform. What you will have is a series of renewals of attempts to control this migration of labor to the United States.
So people like the what do you call them, the Minutemen, what do they call?
Yeah.
Gilchrist, all these people against immigrants.
Yeah.
Do you think they are correct in the sense that they see they're anti-corporations also, right? because I know John Earl's interviewed some of these people, and he finds that they are actually kind of a besieged population in a sense, that they see forces out of their control, and so the way they react is they say, no, we don't want these people here.
It reminds me, in a way, it reminds me of how the Chinese were dealt with that in the late 19th century, in that some organizations of craftsmen and so on saw the Chinese, small agriculturalists, saw the Chinese as the supply of labor that the large growers were utilizing, and making it impossible for these smaller ranchers and so on to succeed. And so they thought, well, if you get rid of the Chinese, then there's a level playing field. And so the rather than looking at this disproportional size of capital, the distribution of capital, rather than looking at the large growers as their competitors, they looked at the Chinese as really the cause of their problem. If we got rid of them, then there's a level playing field. I get the idea sometimes that these are people who are small business people, I'm not sure, who see their middle class standard of living being eroded, because it is. Pensions are being done away with, health care the educational system is not doing all that well. Privatization is not working in the interest of middle class people, and it appears to me that what they see is the undocumented, who are a boon for agriculture, right, and the surface industry and the construction industry. I mean, 37% of employees in the construction industry are immigrants, and we could probably, speculate that probably a good portion of those are undocumented. But they see their own place in the economy as eroding. But that's part of free trade. That's the neoliberal model. It's privatization across the board. It's a system where the schooling system is no longer what it was when I was a kid. You know, you went to school. Nowadays, you pay for everything. I mean, you're really putting out a lot of money for public education now, and privatization model. So I am speculating that this is to some degree a reaction. It's misdirected, a reaction to what neoliberalism is doing to people. Migration, however, is caused by the actions of American capital, and they don't want to deal with that. That's too big a problem. It's much easier than just to deal with the symptom of the problem, which is migrants coming to the United States, and as well as to ignore how significant and important immigrants have been, particularly undocumented immigrants, to the American economy. And they don't realize that while they claim that these immigrants are Latinizing the United States, they're really integrated into the American economy. They are integral to the American economy. And I think this is the irony, in that here we have a day without Mexicans, and now they're saying, oh, you can't do that. You can't do that now. That's going too far. See, they're un-American and so on. But people like Gilchrist would say, fine, get rid of all of them. But they don't want to. They don't want all of them to do it on their own. Were they to do it on their own, then they're trying to harm us. They're trying to harm us.
How about this idea of some people are complaining about raising of Mexican flags?
Yeah. That doesn't bother me at all. In New York City, there was a big demonstration in favor of immigration reform, and there were flags from around the world. And I would prefer that.
Yeah,
I would prefer that. I think this is a nation of many peoples. And I have no problems with that at all.
I think as an anarchist, I would prefer no flags. But
or the symbols of a people.
Yeah, symbols
and
of
I
people.
Or the language of the people.
Right.
I don't have any problem with the nation.
Mm-hmm.
Because Mexico, to me, has lost its sovereignty. It's no longer a sovereign nation.
So the flag to you doesn't represent the state necessarily?
No, it represents the independence of Mexico. And it's a reality that doesn't exist anymore. When I mentioned the free trade agreement and the loss of the ability of Mexico to feed itself, that is a loss of a very fundamental feature of a nation state,
mm-hmm.
the ability to feed itself. Now Mexico cannot feed itself. And it's lost that element of its sovereignty, so that I think we have to talk about how Mexico has become an economic colony of the United States.
Mm.
And also we also have to bring the word imperialism out.
Yeah, really.
And rather than have it tucked away conveniently so that we can talk about it as perhaps an occasional aberration that American foreign policy has engaged in, but it's a policy which has been in place for a century now. And it is that policy in relation to Mexico which has resulted in this continual migration of people to the United States. It hasn't been any clearer than today with the free trade agreement in that Mexico has lost its national sovereignty. And I think Ernesto Galarza would agree with me on that. And I think he has his work has to be listened to very, very carefully, and reviewed.
What are some of his books?
Well, he wrote his work on the Bracero program. He wrote several on the Bracero program, and they are indictments of the way Mexican labor has been treated. Now, one of the things that Galarza pointed out in a talk given to Chicanos in the late 60s, early 70s, I remember in San Diego, he said Mexico is a huge labor pool, which is dipped into whenever necessary by American capital. One of the things that he didn't do, and that I tried to do, in my book on guest workers or colonized labor,
mm-hmm.
Which has a little story. Do we have time for a little story?
Sure. Yes.
Okay.
A few minutes.
I gave a talk at the Green Party here in Orange County. They asked me to give a talk on Mexican migration, so I gave my talk. And I basically summarized over the course of a half hour, 45 minutes or so, what Raul and I wrote about as the economic causes of Mexican migration to the U.S., we essentially employed the Galarza model, and we went and added our own work on there. And we looked at how the actions of American capital uprooted people on a massive scale, mm-hmm. and that migration continues to the United States. Not push-pull, right,
mm-hmm,
but a
mm-hmm.
single migratory flow.
Mm.
And I gave this talk, and at the end of the talk, questions and answers, time to go home, and I'm walking to my car, and this fellow who was in the audience calls me, and he says, your talk that you gave, it reminded me very much of what occurred in India, in his native India. And he said it just was very similar. And I thought, well, I asked him for some books that I could read, and I didn't have any. But anyway, I started to study the contract labor program that the British used mm-hmm. in colonial India. And then I was it was suggested that I looked at Algeria. They had another contract labor program, and I compared the Bracero program, U.S. guest worker program, to the British contract labor program during the colonial era and the French contract labor program with Algeria during the colonial era, and the parallels were striking. The most striking parallel was the actions of British and French imperialist policies on landowning systems in their countries, massive uprootings of people and sending them on a migratory trail within the colony. Mm. The very same thing happens in Mexico because of the actions, not of Mexican capital or Mexican economic policies or decisions, because of the actions of American capital. That's the key fundamental that I found in all of these, and that's why I think that Mexico is a virtual colony of the United States.
So these reforms aren't going to solve anything?
No. The reform is doing away with free trade. That's the beginning of a reform. That will slow down migration. The creation of an independent Mexico that is not subjected to the economic power of the United States.
I guess the lesson from your talk is that we forget history at our peril.
I think
we have to read history.
Well, sometimes we don't forget. We haven't yet acknowledged a very fundamental characteristic of the United States, that it is an imperialist power. And we don't just forget it. We ignore it. We dismiss it.
Because we're in the belly of the beast.
We are the inheritors of the British Empire, and we've done. People like Henry Kissinger, Charles Krauthammer, William Rusher, a whole series of neoconservative pundits have come out to declare that the United States is now an imperialist power that is doing good around the world. And what the average American has not done is to appreciate that.
I went to a Vietnamese scholars conference, and there was a scholar there saying imperialism is good.
Oh, well, that's what the neoconservative pundits are saying, is that we're exporting freedom, democracy, liberty, the American well-being. But, you know, the Merriam-Webster Dictionary defines imperialism as a system of domination. And that's what imperialism is a system of economic domination or territorial domination, either one of the two. And the U.S. has chosen to dominate the world militarily as well as economically. It's going to pay for it, too, unfortunately.
For sure. Yes, on that note. Thank you very much, Professor Gil Gonzalez of Chicano Latino Studies here at UC Irvine. And we'll keep in touch. And
thank you very much.
On your projects. That was Professor Gil Gonzalez at an earlier show during May Day this year. May Day, of course, is celebrated as Labor Day all over the world. This is Dan Zhang signing off for Subversity here on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. You can go to the web at kuci.org/tudor. DTSANG